2GS, and I'm operator for this. I will be AY2M co-host into amateur radio tech. The purpose of this is to invite a forum for this and to open and all parameters as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. Also, we offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange colored type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, you can just type puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of each month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, www.kc2rc.com. Members, as well as non-members, are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. By the way, an application is available on our club website. No question is too simple, no question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your name, your call sign, and whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try my best to provide an answer, and Gene KY2MY will join in. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here or use our email address, tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Gene KY2MY. Good evening, Gene.
Good evening, Roy, AC2GS. This is Gene Q Yankee 2, Mike Yankee. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Tech Deck. Back to you, Roy.
Tonight, if anyone has any questions or comments for the technical net and wants to put their name down on the list, please hit that push to talk button. Give me your first name and your call sign.
Kilo Delta 2, Mike Lima, Yankee Joe here from Brooklyn. Good evening, Roy. With a question.
Joe recognized. Anyone else want to get on the list for tonight?
KD2PUW, Jason in Ridgewood, Queens, with a question. Good evening.
Recognize. Anyone else want to put their name down on the list for tonight?
No. KC2WTA, Staten Island.
Anyone else want to put their name down on the list for tonight? We will start off with Joe, KD2MLY. What's your question for tonight, Joe?
KD2MLY. Okay, Roy, so probably a relatively simple question for probably everyone listening. So I'll keep it brief. Dipole antennas. So a hamstick dipole. So we have two 10-meter hamsticks or two 20-meter hamsticks, and I have a dipole mount. But I'm not sure what would be the front-facing portion of the dipole, right? So I'm trying to get it to face away from me and out from the terrace, and I'm not sure if I have it backwards. Is it where the coax attaches to the cable, to the rear of one of the hamsticks? Should that be the furthest, the front portion of the dipole, and then the second, where it's terminated, should be the rear or vice versa? Thanks, Roy.
Joe, not quite sure if I'm imagining it right in my mind. Dipoles are balanced antennas. It has two elements on either side, so the name dipole, resonant, hopefully. It could either be mechanically resonant by being a quarter wavelength in length on either side, minus a little bit for the end effect, which is a mild capacitive effect, or it can be loaded with an inductor somewhere along and electronically made to be resonant for a quarter wave, even though it's mechanically much shorter. Dipoles have a gain of about 2.15 decibels, which means that in the direction of the dipoles going out is the weakest portion of the signal. At a right angle to the two dipoles is the strongest signal over 360 degrees. So there's no real back and front when it comes to a dipole. There are simply back, front, and side. So you want it pointed in the back to front type of position at a right angle to the line that the vertical is running. Does that make sense?
Roy, it all made sense to the very, with the exception of the very last sentence. Should run point to the most vertical portion. I didn't get that last part.
I misspoke. It's the horizontal. It's the right angle to the horizontal aspect of the dipole. So in other words, if your dipole is, if one leg is pointed north, the other pointed south, you'll get your best reception east and west. Okay?
Okay, thank you. And so with that in mind, the east and west portions, there's no front, there's no rear, there's no front facing or rear facing, in other words.
A dipole is symmetrical. Yagis are not. Yagis have reflectors behind, which reflect the signal forward, and then they have shorter directors in front, which direct the path of the radiating emission forward. So those have back to front ratios. Dipoles don't have a back to front ratio. They have a front to side, if you will. That's where the 2.15 decibel gain of a dipole over a so-called isotropic antenna, which would be sort of like the RF version of an incandescent light bulb, where it shines all over the place 360 degrees.
Okay, Roy, thank you. Because I've been getting mixed information, and I've had failed attempts on numerous types of dipoles in my setup here, and I thought that it would be an ideal setup for a dipole, at least for a 10-meter dipole, being at least 18 feet wide and so high up, but I was told that I was probably connecting the dipole mount in the wrong direction and probably had the dipole mount facing to the rear when it should be facing forward, and that all depended on where the terminated side was on. So, but now you just made it very clear, and I appreciate that. Thank you. But that's all I have. Back to you, Net Control.
Very good, Joe. Anyone else with any comments, questions, or observations about this subject?
Roy, I have a question about this. KD2OVM.
A question about this particular thing or just a question?
About this particular thing, something came in mind. I don't know if it's an absurd question, or somebody already experimented with this and there's already results about it. They use, but not on a dipole, a regular antenna, let's say for Wi-Fi, is very, very used, like a parabolic kind of thing. So it will be like a more like a reflector thing on the regular antenna. What about, how does it work on a, let's say on a dipole, if somebody did this kind of thing, It looks more like a Yagi kind of thing, but I haven't seen it on a well, maybe we've seen on a Yagi's, but I mean on a parabolic way, not as a Yagi way that you can add a reflector on the back, more like a parabolic, and if that thing will absorb the signal going from one way and make it go to the front if it's a bigger element. Back to you, Roy. KD2OBM.
Axel, parabolic antennas are highly directional. Rather than a Yagi, which has a parasitic reflector behind it, you're putting up an entire layer of conductor that's operating sort of like a super reflector and narrowing the directionality a great deal. So effectively, if you could do it, and you can do that with 2400 megahertz, you know, 2.4 gig, because the size of the reflector isn't very big. It's not really a useful approach for HF because the size of the parabolic that you would require would be a major undertaking, and so that's why when people need a directional HF antenna, they go to things like Yagi's rather than that. But a parabolic reflector can be used as a reflector to narrow the area of radiation and increase the gain in that direction.
Appreciate the answer, Roy, about this. Okay, it clarifies. It's more like an impractical thing to do. Okay, that answers the question. KD2OVM.
Unfortunately, a lot of things are highly dependent upon mechanical limitations of sizes. You know, when wavelengths are large as opposed to wavelengths being small. If you increase the diameter of a wire on a dipole, you actually decrease the Q and increase the resonant bandwidth, which is a very practical thing to do, except that if you have a dipole that's made out of diameter copper, you know, 3 feet of diameter copper, it would weigh a ton. But what you can do is trick Mother Nature a little bit. Mother Nature really doesn't know the difference between a thin cage of metal and a solid cylinder of metal. So that's why every so often you might see radons and cage antennas, in which rather than a single dipole wire, you have a cage being made that effectively works like a very, very thick dipole. So sometimes you can play tricks with Mother Nature, and you can get away with mechanical limitations, but sometimes you can't.
About the last part, I would need to see some kind of example with my eyes. I can't imagine that. Yes, the first part that you say, that the thicker the element, the wider you have possibilities to move that on the band. But I have to see what you're trying to explain, like replacing that for my Mother Nature in order to trick it. Instead of being something big material, will be looking more like a cage. I want to see that. Do you have any like link, Roy, about that? KD2OVM.
One right now, but I am more than happy to email you a link. All you have to do is Google probably cage antenna would bring up a lot of images. But after the net is over, I will get together a little collection of images of this type and email it to you.
No, okay. With that, with those words, I can go to my friend Google. I'm not going to bother you, Roy, with that. KD2OVM.
Good. It's sort of amazing. I mean, if you look up skin effect, when you get into RF, a very, very, very narrow amount of conductor is doing all the conduction of your RF. You may think that nice, big, thick central conductor in your coax is carrying all the kinds of current that you're sending it, but it's really riding on the very, very surface of that piece of wire. In the same way with the outer shielding, the inner aspect of your outer shielding has almost all of that portion of the RF you're transmitting to the antenna. None of it is riding on the outer surface of the braid. The common mode, if you have reflections and you get RF in your shack, is coming from the reflected common mode bouncing off and returning on the upper surface. So skin effect is a very important thing to keep in mind with amateur radio.
Really appreciate all this information. No, it's very useful and new ideas that they come out to clarify more how this works, Roy. Definitely it is. KD2OVM, really useful information.
Welcome, Axel. Anyone else with any other comments, questions, or comments related to this this area of technology? KD2PUW, what's your question for tonight?
Hey, Roy. Thanks for turning it over. KD2PUW. My question is regarding audio. So I've got my dipole antenna all nice and efficient and resonant. And now I'm concerned about audio on single sideband. My question is, are there any hard and fast principles regarding maintaining a good, clear signal on the sidebands?
Jason, there's lots of rules and differing opinions, and unfortunately, like most things that get complicated, it depends upon what you want to do. There are certain ways of going about audio that would be best if you were into rag chewing, and there are others that would be more useful to you if you were into distant communication, where the communications tended to be more problematic, fading and static and QRM and such. Generally speaking, readability is the most important thing. Somewhat fidelity in the first 3,000 hertz of your voice. Anything higher is nice, but not necessary for readability. You want to have a reasonable equalization so that you sort of sound the way that you always sound. If you try to boost up the bass, it can become a little tubby. And that's not great. If you boost up the high end, it can lead to a lot of hiss and noise and a lot more sibilance than you want. If you're going for distance, people put compressors on. It helps. It boosts up the signal. Sometimes people will tweak the high end a little bit and drop the low end for distance because the sibilance kind of travel on the higher frequencies. So there's a lot of little tricks that people use. It's always good to either be in an environment where you can listen to your own signal, or if you have a friend who has a good ear who can kind of give you a sense of whether the high end's too peaked or the low end's too tubby and what have you.
All right, Roy. Give me a bit to think about there. I appreciate the answer.
Anyone else with any opinions about how to get the best audio settings for a single sideband operation? No comment. Single sideband is a little different than amplitude modulation. Amplitude modulation is usually a much wider a band of 6 kilohertz or more. Most single sideband tries to stay within about 3 kilohertz. There is something called extended single sideband, which is people who use a wider bandwidth. That gives them better fidelity at the higher end. It augments the voice without making it that much more readable, but it's more pleasing to the ear, except for the guy trying to communicate 3 kilohertz away from your transmission. in which it collides with it. But there is extended single sideband as an option, but single sideband is usually about 3 kilohertz. Some people kind of narrow it a little bit, others widen it just a touch, but 3,000 is the rough guidelines. And that's as far as I can think of just saying right now. Again, anyone else have any questions or comments about this topic? Way.
Okay, Roy, about this KD2OBM. So, of course, in the practice, there is the 3 kilohertz, but let's say on the HF, there's filters, and they always try to go to make the bandwidth going to the narrow side in order to filter up things. And that will improve, let's say, for us to hear, but that comes out with consequences on the, what is it called, on the quality on the audio too. Okay, we are able to distinguish what the other person is saying, but we are losing on other things. Can you please elaborate on the consequences when we apply those filters in order to, let's say, remove noises, make the band a little more narrow, etc.? KD2OVM.
Axel, certainly. The way things work is different bandwidths have different signal-to-noise characteristics. That's why something like Morse code that can have a 300 hertz bandwidth cuts right through a lot of the noise, and people who use QRP, low 5-watt rigs, prefer to do Morse code because a given amount of watts over 200 hertz is more effective than the same amount of watts over 3,000. So in one way, the narrower the bandwidth, the more you cut out the background noise, the more punch your signal has. But human speech requires a certain amount of range for intelligibility, readability. So if you narrow down the human voice sufficiently to optimize the punching through of your signal, you pay the price for losing a lot of the information that's in the high and low registers. So it's a happy medium. Some people run 2.4 kilohertz. It gets rid of some of the noise, gets rid of the hiss, drops the sibilances a bit and might make it a little bit more difficult for readability. But if the background noise is really very bad, that might be a reasonable price to pay. But like all good things, you pay a price for everything. The narrower the bandwidth, the less intelligible human speech becomes. Ma Bell, way back, did loads of studies, and they were the people who came up with the idea of a 3 kilohertz bandwidth for single sideband, and amateur radio just adopted it. It's a nice, moderate decision. But you can go narrower, and people have all kinds of filter bands that do that well, and people find it fine. You pretty much have to adjust your bandwidth, if you're able to, for the environment. If it's a noisy environment, if it's a bad signal, you want to narrow it out and try to understand the person as best you can. If it's a nice big booming signal and you want to enjoy the full range of their transmission, you can widen it out to their entire transmission bandwidth. So that's offhand what I have to say on that subject. Any comments about that? Axel, was that an adequate explanation?
Yes, Roy. I have plenty now to look into more information here, but I was trying to get a little more onto the idea of what you're losing there and how does it come to be the 3,000 kilohertz over that, and more or less it explains how it's made up. And yes, and it's up to each person to modify those kind of things on the bandwidth in order to try to get it right.
if we can use the 3,000, great, but if we can't because the conditions don't help, we're going to pay up on something. But I like also what you said, that the narrower, the more power you can put into it, and the further you can go to lose quality. But yes, KD2 OVM. Thank you, Roy.
Welcome. So Jason, did we answer your question sufficiently?
This is KD2PW. Roy, yes, you did. Thanks to you, and thanks to Axel.
Good. Next on my list that I've written down is Joe KC2 WTA.
Good evening, Roy, and everyone else on the net. I'm glad I'm one of the last participants because this is not an amateur radio question. I wanted you to talk about your experience so far with 3D printing and how do you go from drawings and dimensions to an actual three-dimensional object. KC2, WTA.
Well, as a start, because I maybe a little too much, found a new hobby printing. It's very popular among so-called makers. You see a lot of YouTubes about it. There are all kinds of 3D printers. They range from, in price, the cheapest are the Chinese, of course. You could probably get one for under $200 with shipping. It goes all the way up into the stratosphere. The primary method is using filament. What you do is you end up buying rolls of plastic, usually about 1.75 millimeters. There's also 3-millimeter filament. And you heat them up and extrude them out of an extruder, and there's some servos or stepper motors that work the X, Y, and Z coordinates, and you simply pour the molten plastic on top of each layer and build a three-dimensional structure with surprising detail. Some 3D printers are capable of a 50 micron, that's 0.05 millimeters. Of resolution, although mine is 150 microns, or 0.15. There's different types of plastics. There's PLA, which is biodegradable, and it's very easy to use, but if you put it in a parked car in the middle of the summer, the heat will probably melt it. There's ABS, which has a higher melting point and much better suited for more outside environments. You can go anywhere you want with any color, and there's a bunch of different compounds that you could use other than ABS and PLA. Let me drop for a sec. There's fire for the esoteric, there's nylon, and there are other forms of plastic. And they all have slightly different characteristics and require nudging the controls a bit. If you like something to set and forget, this is not probably the hobby for you. There is a degree of tuning required. You can keep with a single brand of 3D printer and 3D printer filament, and pretty much it sets itself. If you want to try out another company's filaments or a different type of filament or a color that the brand doesn't have, then be prepared to spend some time, money, and plastic in finding the right settings for it. And as Joe asked me, there are two ways of finding stuff to 3D print. The easiest way is there's a lot of websites, Thingiverse, you just do a Google search and you'll find these repositories of people who are much more talented than I am, who've made all kinds of things. They've 3D scanned all kinds of things and they give it to you for free. You download it and you print it at your whatever scale, at your heart's content. But if you are so inclined to do it yourself, there are ways of doing it yourself. There is a web-based 3D CAD system called Tinkercad. Just Google Tinkercad, and it allows you to do a complex 3D modeling. You can define circles and boxes and other shapes and then extrude them a given length and a given distance and form different things. There are other 3D modeling software out there. Blend 3R is more of an amorphous blending, a 3D modeler where it's like sculpting. So you can pull and push on little portions of a blob that you make and make your own sculptures. And then there's AutoCAD, which has a very professional 3D CAD software called 360. You can get access to it for free for something like 3 years if you just tell them that you're a hobbyist. So there's a whole bunch of different either free or next to free for years software out there. It only depends upon your skill with the software. It's not as simple as drawing a picture because you have to now draw a three-dimensional picture. So it takes a little bit of skill, especially in learning the way the software thinks about the world. But it's possible to do. You certainly can do simple shapes, spheres and boxes and toruses and such, and you can merge them together and play with that. So that's my quick little take on the world of 3D printing. Any other aspect that I missed, Joe?
I don't think so. Could you elaborate on 3D scanning?
Some people have done it successfully. It's much more an art than a science, and also the more money you throw at it, the better it is. If you would do a search on Amazon, which I always kind of use as a template of figuring out where technology is, you will find, again, Chinese manufacturers. So usually when it's a Chinese manufactured thing, it's inexpensive. It's kind of lower end. Selling 3D scanners for thousands of dollars. This is probably not a great thing to see because it means that there's really no inexpensive, simple, easy method. Now, there is software available that will take your two-dimensional images. You take a picture of the front and the sides and the back, and it will stitch it together and try and make it into a 3D model. Usually not terribly successful. Reflectivity of the object kind of gets in the way sometimes. Other aspects get in the way. And most of the times that I've seen 3D scans using photo stitching, you have to enter it into some kind of a 3D modeling software and fix the really bad portions of it. But it is doable. And again, if you have a lot of money to throw at it, there's a lot of very, very esoteric stuff out there. Again, just Google Amazon for a 3D scanner. They use laser lights. They use multiple camera images to capture things and develop a three-dimensional grid and then reconstruct it into small triangles and such. It's sort of fascinating. Some of the things in Thingiverse and others have been scanned into it. There are busts of Einstein and Tesla and all kinds of famous people, and for the most part, those were done by scans and then a cleanup. So I wish I could tell you that it was easy to 3D scan. In the old days, about 4 or 5 years ago, there were American companies that sold 3D printers and also sold scanners. They've sort of stopped doing that. My guess is because they got way too many complaints for the scanner, so they decided to just concentrate on the 3D printing problems alone. So that's my 2 cents worth as far as the scanners are involved.
Hey, Roy, thanks very much. KC2WTA.
Else with any questions, if you want to, anyone late or just thought of the question, if you have one, just give me your name and your call sign. An opportunity for this episode, Kings County Radio Club Technical Net Puzzle. The question, as posted on the website, is ALC stands for Choice A is automatic level control. Choice B is audio low-pass coil. Choice C is alternating local current. And choice D is antenna loading choke. So would anyone like to try their luck and tell me what ALC stands for in amateur radio?
ALC stands for automatic level control.
Quite right, Jason. It's automatic level control. Unfortunately, I can't kind of give any words of wisdom of how you would know this without just knowing what the abbreviation stands for. Automatic level control is an interesting concept, an interesting circuit. It's a circuit that involves both a transmitter and linear amplifiers. In the olden days, what would happen is as your transmitter's driver fed signal into your linear amplifier, your linear amplifier would assess the level of the signal. If it was above the specifications for a linear amplification, it would then send a negative voltage potential over a control line. That in the old days, when there were vacuum tubes in your final transmitter power amplifier, would be connected to your grid, and a negative voltage potential on your grid would lower the gain and thus auto-correct your over-driving your linear amplifier. Nowadays, a lot of this is solid state, but they still use negative voltage potentials as ways to control the output driver of your transmitter so that it doesn't overdrive your linear amplifier, which could lead to either failure or lead to it amplifying in a non-linear way and produce a lot of harmonics that would spew noise all over the spectrum. So that's the automatic level control. It's very similar, by the way, to the automatic gain control, except that automatic gain control is at the receiver circuit and used more to control the audio output so you don't rupture your eardrums. Also, the circuits involved in the automatic level control as far as the transmitter is concerned is usually the same as the circuit that is used for it to fold over to a lower power if it senses a high standing wave ratio. I'm sure many of you have heard stories of people who were trying to transmit and they had very little output, and when they checked their standing wave ratio, they were trying to transmit 3-1, 4-1, 5-1. Nowadays, transmitters are very smart that way. They see the reflected power and they go into fold over or fold back mode. And it's using the same basic circuitry as the automatic level control. So that's my little thing on automatic level controls. Very useful. Some people swear by them. Few people swear at them because they can cause some slight non-linearity as well, depending upon how they're designed and how it works in that particular setup. But it's a very common control, and it's always good to know that. Any other comments or questions about automatic level controls?
KTPW is the question. I only have a 20-meter dipole set up. I spent a lot of time on 20 meters. And there's this one station. He likes to hang out and rag chew on about 14.280. And his signal must be 5-plus kilohertz wide. And the guy is just insanely loud. I was just wondering if that non-linearity, would that be a... is that what non-linearity looks like, or is that something else?
For the most part, non-linearity is more producing distortion. It's sort of vaguely in the same way if you up the mic gain, and I'm sure you've talked to people in the past who overdrove their mic, their audio distorted. So the same thing can happen with RF, and it affects the audio envelope as well. Also, it generates harmonics and such. So not only can it kind of smear across beyond the 3 kilohertz, it could end up showing up in multiple harmonics up and down the band. So it could be a bunch of things. I mean, this guy could be overdriving. He could be too close to you, so your front end is a little bit set too sensitive, and you might want to crank down the gain control and such, the RF gain. Or he very possibly is doing ESSB. He might be transmitting with a much wider bandwidth. My radio can adjust on the fly. I can sort of set it for any width I so want. I don't do that because, again, it upsets people who are 3 kilohertz in either direction and want to use the same band. So that's kind of the gist of the type of nonlinear distortion an overdriven linear amplifier will do.
Thanks very much, KDTPUW.
Very good. Anyone with any other comments or questions for the technical net tonight? It is really noisy tonight. Well, I'll give everyone one last chance if they have any questions or comments that they feel so inclined, and give you one more chance, and then we pull down the curtain for tonight. Okay, very good. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesday of each month. Our next meeting will be March 6th. We meet 7 o'clock to 8 o'clock for a question and answer technical session, very informal, and then from 8 on for our general meeting. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday at 9 p.m. on this repeater, as well as a 10-meter net every Sunday at 11 a.m. on 28.380 megahertz upper sideband. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesday of each month at 9 p.m. We also have a weekly net featuring Yaesu's Fusion Digital Technology every Thursday at 9 p.m. on our club repeater, KC2RC. If you can communicate using Fusion technology, please join in. We offer an audio stream of FusionNet on the Internet at stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And by the way, an application is always available on our website. If you would like to contact the host of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company 3 Alien Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. Also, starting, I think, this Friday night at 9 p.m., Mitch N2RGA will be beginning a Fusion Technology swap and shop. So that's Fridays, I believe, at 9 p.m. So check it out if you have access. And even if you don't, you can still listen to the Audible stream. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. It's time to roll this all up, shut this all down, and call it a day. But we'll be back to do it all over again on February 27th, and you're all welcome to join us. Thanks to all the people that participated tonight, and especially to Gene, KY2MY. Without you guys, I'd just be talking to myself. So, this is Roy, AC2GS, going clear, and getting the heck out of here. Until next time, guys, take it easy.
Roy, AC2GS, this is Gene, QYankee2, Mike Yankee, also signing out. Good evening.
KD2OVM.
Thank you, Roy. Thanks, everybody. Very informative net. KD2PUW.
Thanks, Roy. KDTO, more likely.